So we're here today with Sean Ryan, who's running for mayor on the Democratic line. So thanks for being here.
Great to be here today.
And so I want to do a series of conversations about what I'm going to call the health of the city. And there's a lot of things that this broadly covers, and we'll get into each of them separately in different conversations. But what I want to start with today is how the city works, or for that matter, doesn't work for the people who live here. And the reason I want to get into that is because I think there's great dissatisfaction sort of in the country in general with how government works. And oftentimes, most of our interaction with government is at the local level. So I think that dissatisfaction has led to things like Donald Trump. It's led to Mamdani's upset in New York. And closer to home, I think India Walton's surprise primary win a few years ago. And she probably would have been mayor if it hadn't been for a very well-organized counter effort.
And I would continue on that. I think my mayoral victory is a result of that same dissatisfaction, because, the long-standing mayor tried to, hand off the mayor to his hand-picked guy.
So that, yeah. And so I think that speaks again to this, like, people are becoming, I think, skeptical of the status quo and the system.
Yep, I believe that.
So today I want to get into something. So I want you to address a problem, something that you see in the way the city operates, the way it interacts with the citizens, the people that live here, and how you would go about approaching that and fixing it in sort of very matter-of-fact ways.
Yeah, so my campaign really was based on the basics, that the city stop performing the basics of government. They stop plowing the streets. They stop fixing the potholes. They stopped opening the pools and fixing community centers. And people acutely felt that. They felt as though the government, didn't work for them. So we are going to concentrate on getting what I consider the basics done right. And then once people see they're done right, then they'll have a greater confidence, because then we have to then tackle, the actually more complex problems that we have in the city. The tens of thousands of vacant lots, the income disparity, the results of redlining, black home ownership rate well lower than the black home ownership national average, social determinants of health. Like, we have real big problems to face. But not only have we ignored those problems for a generation, we at the same time started ignoring the deliverance of basic governmental services, things that should happen without you as a resident even thinking about it.
One of the things I think about, so if you're talking about like the basic things that are supposed to happen, there's multiple reasons why things don't work properly. And one of the big reasons, I think, and the hardest thing to change is the mindsets of the people that sort of control these systems. And so how do you get in there and sort of turn things around?
Well, you have to bring in, a whole outside level of management. So we need to have people with fresh approaches and fresh ideas, but you also need to communicate with the workforce. The City of Buffalo workforce is eager. They're frustrated. They're as frustrated as the citizens are. Well, they, say that we were never given the tools to do this job right. You talk to people who do sanitation work, and they'll tell you exactly how the routes should be changed. You talk to the people who do snow plowing, and they'll tell you exactly why the streets aren't plowed. So they're frustrated, themselves. So you have to put whole new systems in place. But this is the systems that, Tonawanda does every day of the week. That Hamburg does, that Cheektowaga does. So these aren't complex things to fix. You just have to have the will. But you also have this, you have to have, what else has been missing is just a commitment to excellence. And that's what we need to install in the city, and it's got to start at the top. We expect excellence. We expect everything to be done well, the way it's supposed to be done, with a high level of customer service too. So a lot of that stuff is just, it's the basics.
It is, and I would agree with you that I think in any organizational structure, business, whatever it is, government, you know, the mindset starts at the top. You know, I've always said, like, if you go into a store and you get treated poorly by the staff that's working there or a restaurant, you know that they're getting treated poorly, right?
Yep.
So if you start that as mayor, like, are you suggesting that, like, basically we need a wholesale clearing of the sort of top level of city government? Explain to me just quickly, how does it work with, so there's commissioners of all these different departments, and so how does it work as a new mayor comes in and sort of sets their agenda?
Yeah, there's commissioners, and there's something, you know, in layman's terms, deputy commissioners, who are supposed to tell everyone, here's the mission of this department, and here's where we're going to do it. But obviously, based on what we're seeing, you know, things haven't worked, so we're going to have to take a hard look at the managerial workforce, do evaluations, figure out, you know, who wants to stay. There's going to be people leaving before I come in. So there's definitely going to be, you know, Brian Brown and Chris Scanlon loyalists to see the handwriting on the wall, and we'll be gone. But once you make those changes, you know, you have to be clear with the workforce from your manager on down. Here's the mission of the city. Here's the mission of your department. You then need to transfer that and communicate that to everyone in your department. You know, I don't know if in living history, if a mayor has pulled together all the sanitation workers to talk to them about how important their job is to the city. And, you know, without them doing their job every day, the city, you know, won't function. And to applaud them, you know, for the work that they've done, and then come back after big events or big trash pickups and say, great job, we appreciate what you're doing. So that type of management hasn't really existed in City Hall.
So if we take one of the issues that you mentioned, let's say, since we're let's say streets and snow plowing, the sanitation, sure, and snow plowing, they're fairly similar. And so what are some of the other things that other cities are doing, mm-hmm, to make those systems efficient and,
yes, work for the citizens? Yeah. So you don't have to, I just, in the last decade in government, I've represented both Tonawanda and Hamburg. And I've worked closely with their administrations. You know, I watched in wonder of how they attack snowstorms. And they're always open days before Buffalo. And I know everyone's going to say, there's cars parked on the street, and our streets are narrow. Well, we've never bought snowplows to match our narrow streets, and we don't really have a good system to message to people when they should move their cars, you know, and when they should not. But we can't allow that to be the cop-out. Suddenly, Buffalo can't plow its streets because, you know, there's cars parked on the wrong side, and our roads are narrow, right? Every town or city has this unique set of circumstances, but it's your job, you know, to get past those. So I know in those towns I mentioned, their routes have been digitized for a decade. You know, when you get done with a route, you get a new route over your computer, and you follow your new route. You go up on Erie County's website, it'll show which streets have been plowed, how many times they've been plowed, and then the time estimate to what time your street's going to be plowed. So these are systems that governments all around Buffalo have adopted. You know, there's only one place that hasn't adopted any of these items that probably would have been cutting edge 10, 15 years ago, and Buffalo's the only one who hasn't adopted those things. And the town of Tonawanda, they run their garbage routes, and there's always somebody calling and saying, I forgot to put my garbage out, can you send a truck by? If you did that in Buffalo, you know, the people would be laughing. Like, there's no expectation of that. But in Tonawanda, since they say it happens every week, every garbage day, every time a call comes in, they log that call into the system. And then the first truck that's done, once their shift is done, they're given a second route, and it hits all the secondary calls that came in. Holy cow. Like, we can get that done, you know, in the town of Tonawanda? And they're like, this is like basic iPhone technology. Like, we're not going buying expensive systems for this. So there are ways, you know, to get this done that aren't really capital intensive, but you just have to want to adopt new systems.
Yeah, and I think, you know, speaking of a system like that, like, you know, it could have several applications, from garbage to snow plowing to potholes to, like, it could encompass everything that would be, you know, like, I don't know how the 311 system works now, but I suspect that it's, my impression of it is it's fairly archaic.
This is what you're talking about is what we would call in, you know, municipal work, public transparency dashboards, where you can go into the city's website, see when your garbage is getting picked up, see when the streets are being plowed, see when your street's on the list, what year your street will be repaved. All that stuff should be out there, transparent. So if you're not going to say what your goals are, well, how are you ever going to be judged on whether or not you met your goals? So, you know, and then this also goes to the, you know, the basic hide the ball nature of city government. You know, the county, when polling cars came in, you know, they had a freedom of information officer, and they spent all this time gathering information and copying it and evaluating requests and sending them out. But, you know, after a very short period of time, they realized, well, all this stuff is public information. Why don't we just put it all on our website? So now most freedom of information requests that go to the county, the response is this information is publicly available on this section of our website. You don't have to go find it. It's all there. Like, we're not hiding anything. But that's the city forever has tried to keep all this stuff, you know, behind closed doors. They've kept it all close to their vest if it's secret information. But it's the public's information. So we're going to get all that out there on a dashboard.
So I think that what that would do is, you know, it would certainly help break down this kind of facade, I guess, that you can't really break through and understand what's actually happening in city government. And so when people don't know what's happening, they generally presume the worst, right?
It's more of a fortress than a right. facade. It's well, a fortress.
True. Yeah.
Try to, you know, who owns this lot? Is it owned by the city? Who owns this building? Like, yeah. You know, even with the Aura system, I know you're familiar with, that system's 20 years old now. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much information that we could just get out to the public, because you're right. People assume if you're shielding something that you're hiding. Mm-hmm. You're hiding it. But the city government has to get used to understanding that this is public information and it should just be available to the public. You shouldn't have to go find it at the end of a maze. It should just be out there for everyone to see.
So one of the other things you brought up was the amount of vacant property, so vacant lots and vacant property that the city owns and stuff. And that's certainly, like, I don't know, I just saw an article on TV or in the paper or something about a lady who lived next to a vacant house on Connecticut Street, and they've been complaining for years, and there were squatters in there, and they set it on fire, and it burned down that house and then burned down her house. So it's, you know, this has been something that's been talked about in Buffalo since I moved here in the 90s. So
since then, we've demolished thousands of new houses to create thousands of new vacant lots owned by the city.
Right. And so how do we, so that is certainly something that I think is both a visible thing, because you see these, you see the vacant properties, you see the vacant lots, but there are also, you know, it does have this other impact on people. It's more than just seeing it, right? It's feeling that the whole system is broken, right? That nobody's here.
Feel you
here.
Live in a chaotic, lawless, right.
so
decaying environment.
Yeah. So how do you?
It's not a good feeling.
It's not. So how that's a big issue, and it's related to a lot of things, from employment to people moving here to, like, mm-hmm. I mean, the fact is we have a city that was, you know, built to hold 600,000 people or close to it. And we're under half that now. So how does the city actually address that in a meaningful way?
There's about 10 to 12,000 vacant lots owned by the city and about 10 to 12,000 vacant lots owned by private individuals. So when I say about, it's because no one seems to have an actual handle on it. You know, it's like the depth of Loch Ness. Everyone's got to, we're not quite sure how deep it is. So, but once again, this goes back to transparency. You have to categorize all your lots. You have to figure out of the vacant lots, which are developable, which are not. And then you have to have neighborhood rebuild plans. You know, so a lot of times when we see areas of Buffalo that are empty, like near the central terminal, there's areas of, you know, just green field. A lot of people see that as like a blank canvas and say, oh, we should do something there. But on most urban development and urban planning, you start at your strengths. So you leave the green field, but you go to like Glenwood, that on one block has three vacant lots and the other block has five. And you strategically do your infill housing on those blocks so that you're capturing your strength of those neighborhoods. And the people who've been living on those blocks, you know, they would like new neighbors in new housing. So you start at your strength, and whether you develop plans around corridors, whether you develop your plans around schools. I mean, you drive around city elementary schools, and they're often surrounded by vacant lots. But we have to make a plan to, you know, what's the highest, best use of this various properties. But you have to really start with the infill, strengthen the existing, you know, neighborhoods. You know, forever people talk about, you know, restoring some commercial corridors in Buffalo. But if you look at a lot of those commercial corridors, the streets that feed right into them, 40-50% of the lots are vacant. Mm-hmm. Well, it defies logic that you think you could get a neighborhood commercial strip going if, in fact, there's no one living in the neighborhood. So you got to put your efforts together. So if you're going to do, you know, the Jefferson Avenue corridor, at the same time, you have to do the feeder streets into Jefferson Avenue to get hundreds of more people on those blocks. Somebody's got to walk to the corner to buy a cup of coffee. You know, that's sort of how neighborhood retail works. So we just had a real lack of looking at any part of the city systemically and coming up with a plan. You know, I did this 20 years ago on the west side with PUSH. We developed a zone starting with the strength of Richmond Avenue, you know, and then going into the west side, we figure out what are the community assets. What vacant lots could become small playgrounds or pocket parks or, you know, community gardens, but then working on to infill the vacant lots and to get money to, you know, redo some of the doubles. And that was largely, that effort was largely successful. It didn't happen overnight. It took years, but nonprofits have been doing this on their own, often fighting the city to get anything done. So we're going to lead a planning effort out of City Hall, where we, you know, we pick strategic neighborhoods around the city, and most of it will be on the east side because that's where most of the damage has been done in the last 30 years to help regrow, you know, neighborhoods. I was, just before I came here, I was down at the Michigan Avenue corridor and, you know, walking around with some folks there, and, you know, they told me their biggest frustration of trying to rebuild that corridor in the last 15 years has just been working with City Hall. A lot of it was about vacant lot transfers. But, you know, to this day, the same problem they were fighting 15 years ago, they still don't have those lots under their control. The state's given tens of million dollars into their corridor, and that work is being delayed because they don't own the lots that they want to put their next buildings on.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that because I actually work closely with them on trying to get some of these properties, and so I'm familiar with that. And again, these are the kind of things that...
years and years and years of banging your head on the exact same issue and then still not having the properties
transferred. Not having the properties, and if you still... But there's no other plan for it other than, no, you can't have it. So I think...
in the absence of doing any planning, it seems any step you make could be a choice-limiting option. Oh, you know, we've been trying to redevelop the Outer Harbor, but we really don't know what we're going to do out there, so we don't really want to do anything because if we give one parcel away, you know, it could muck up the whole planning effort. And that's the same with, like, on Michigan. Like, there's no rational thought that a private individual is going to come and, you know, build the house next to the city's public work barns. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, the city knocked down a lot of those houses themselves in the last two decades.
Yep, I remember.
But there's a community group with a plan that is funded, able, has a great track record. And right now, it's been the same problem for over a decade.
I would agree. And that, I mean, just as a side note about the Michigan Street Commission, I do feel that, you know, very strongly that if that happens the way they really intend, that it will be actually a phenomenal draw. To me, it would be more interesting than Canal Side. Mm-hmm. So
not only be a phenomenal draw, but it'll serve the whole city.
Yes.
Because it'll rebuild those corners, Michigan and Broadway. I mean, you know, the streets there aren't compatible still with what they're trying to do. I mean, the state put Broadway on a lane diet there. So even though it's a very wide street, it's only two lanes. But you turn around on Michigan, and it's actually four lanes in that area on Michigan. So you have to rationalize a lot of the streets and the parkings. But, you know, once again, everyone's so far ahead of us. You know, you want to figure out what to do with that? Go to Pittsburgh. Go to Cleveland. You know, go to Toledo. All these places have tackled the problems that we are still, you know, planning to tackle in Buffalo.
Absolutely. And the one thing that gets at that I want to bring up, because it relates to this relationship between the city and the people, is, you know, in that particular case, we brought up that the city has just said no, right? They don't have a plan for these lots. They don't have any, but the answer is just no. And I was listening to somebody talk a little while ago about bureaucracies and how they operate. And one of the things that came up is that they often are structured so that the person that's saying no, so the person behind the desk that you're meeting with, it's safer for them to say no. Just to blankly say no and to stop the conversation there because of how the whole organizational structure is. So how is there a way to sort of change that dynamic where people can either say yes without fear of repercussion or move something up the ladder that makes sense?
If you create a management structure, you know, several hundred person company, if the city was a company, but if no one can make a move unless one or two people said yes, then inertia and is going to take over, and doing nothing is going to be the opt-out, because then you won't get in trouble. So you have to hire highly qualified commissioners, highly qualified deputy commissioners, and empower them to do their jobs. You know, give them the authority to actually do their jobs. You know, just before the election, there was a flurry of city activity. And I noticed Chapin Parkway got bike lanes painted down. And I dug a little bit. That money came to the city in 2017 to paint those bike lanes. And they did community outreach in 2018. And 7 years later, 2 weeks before an election, finally the bike lanes get painted on. That just shows you the level of dysfunction, you know, in City Hall. You know, they're sitting on over $40 million of state dollars given to the city to repair roads. The only city in upstate that doesn't spend that money as soon as they get it. The city of Buffalo asked to have that money rolled over to the following year because they didn't figure out a way to pay contractors or use their own staff to fix potholes. You know, money to redo Main Street was in front of the medical campus. You know, that Main Street was supposed to be done as soon as Simonelli finished that last building 8-9 years ago, and still not done. So there's a lot of resources that have just been sitting in City Hall, but that no one's really wanted or had the will or the ability. I mean, it's the great mystery to me. Like, why did it take so long to put those stripes on that road?
But also, you know, begs the question, I guess, like, where is the money? Like, is this kind of like some pea soup of like money that's just floating around down there? Or is it held off? Or
no, it's real money. So if you're given state money to fix potholes, at the end of the year, you're supposed to do a report to see how you spent it. If you didn't spend it, you have to ask for dispensation to say, can I carry it over for one other year? You can't take it and do anything else with it. So the money is just sort of sitting in these pots, waiting, you know, to be used. I myself, I got state money to build a pocket park on Niagara and Lafayette several years ago. That lot looks exactly like it did several years ago because the city hasn't took them a couple years to complete the two-sided handwritten grant application. So it really does just go back to this. I'm saying commitment to excellence. That's what I would like to have. But, you know, right now it's more, you know, can you just get the work done?
Yeah.
But we're going to be able to get them. Very optimistic that there's a lot of people who in the city workforce, the blue collar, the white collar workforce, they'll tell you exactly how it should be run. And they have a high degree of frustration that it's not getting done. And, you know, it frustrates them because they have to go to work every day. They're the ones who has to field calls from our citizens saying, what's going on here? I think I might have told you this in our last interview, but my wife, Kathy, pays the property tax bills and user fees. We split it up. But I told her, I said, this year, I can't be late on anything because it'll really look bad. Because sometimes she doesn't mind being a little bit late. And, you know, everything's paid up. And, you know, in the winter, we got a red card, index card in our mailbox saying, you are late on your taxes. And we're like, what's going on? We call. A guy answers finally and says, you know, here's our number. No, you're fine on your taxes. Click. We call back. Someone else answers. You're fine on your taxes. But why did we get this red card? That was a mistake. We send out a batch of those red your late cards to a lot of people, but it was a mistake. You can disregard it. And you think, you know, my wife and I are both lawyers. We're sophisticated. You imagine what the other thousands of people thought when they get a card in the mail saying that they're late with their taxes? At least the second person who called, but that office was clearly overwhelmed and inundated with phone calls. But no one in city government shifted resources to that department for those days to field all those calls. So instead, you're just being left with a, you know, ring, 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 ring. And all campaign season, I was knocking on doors. You know, it was a constant joke amongst folks of, oh, yeah, I called 311 on that. I almost broke my finger. I called so many times and nothing happens. So, you know, this is where you get this cynicism of what's going on? Like, why can't we do it better? But I know we can do it better. You know, it's in front of us. We know how to do it. And we're going to turn that around. But we're not going to set up, you know, fake systems that are designed to make people think your complaint has been heard. But nothing happens with that. You don't get a follow up after you call. They don't tell you the action that took place, but you can mostly see with your own eyes that no action took place. In 311 may have been a cutting edge idea 20 years ago. But, you know, I call my bank, I don't get a human answering the call. You know, there's we're going to look at the most modern ways, you know, to handle these calls, but it has to be when, whether it's a call, a text, or an email, when it comes in, something has to happen with that. And there has to be an expectation internally that those complaints are addressed when they're given to departments.
One of the other things I wanted to ask
you. I feel like I'm explaining why basics need to be done.
Well, it is. I mean, you are.
Yeah.
That's a simple fact, is there is this feeling that the basics aren't getting done. And so it does create this broad pessimism. And I do think, like I said, I think that these things trickle uphill in some ways, because most of our interaction as people, if we're interacting with government, it's at the local level.
Yes.
And so people's dissatisfaction with government often comes from our interaction at the local level, whether it's going down to City Hall. Like
I wish I could disagree with you. Yeah, but I can't. So, but one thing we owe ourselves, you know, especially me as a proud Democrat, we owe it to the residents, but also to our beliefs in government, to govern well and to govern effectively. I mean, you know, the best anecdote to fascism is functioning government. Like, people only turn to extremism, you know, and fascism and tea parties and MAGA when they think the system's not working. Yeah. So let's go make it work.
Absolutely. I mean, I would agree completely with that. And when people feel left out or, you know, discarded in some way, which is, you know, if you have lived on the east side of Buffalo, it's easy to feel that you have been sort of forgotten about and essentially discarded.
Well, but so, isn't that just the truth?
It is, yes.
Yeah, that we've had generations of intentional governmental policy that segregated, you know, that denied resources. The east side looks like it does because of generations of bad, you know, Jim Crow of the North type policies. But we haven't taken any real steps to remedy that. You know, how we distribute street aid in the city, I'm not quite sure how it's distributed, but I know it's not distributed based on need. Because if it was distributed based on need, my street wouldn't have been paved 3 times in the last 20 years. And Paderewski, you know, looks like Beirut. So, you know, we've left parts of the city behind. But, you know, we need to acknowledge how we got there. But then we need to change it. And you can show that change quickly. You know, I lived in New York City when David Dinkins was elected. And my neighborhood in, you know, New York City was borderline. It was poor people. It was very mixed race. But that first spring, all those neighborhoods got paved. And they had been ignored, you know, for a generation by previous mayors. And that really sent a message that everyone in the city matters. And that's this type of message that I want to send, you know, throughout the city. You know, it's symbolic, but it's deeply, deeply meaningful. And you got to get a little geeky about potholes, right? Because potholes just aren't an inconvenience. Potholes are a cost. Mm-hmm. Like the car repair cost, you know, it's the equivalent of like a $1,200 a year tax if you live somewhere with bad roads. So, you know, it's not just an inconvenience. And, you know, we make jokes about playing Frogger, but, you know, you go to any of the tire and front end shops in the city of Buffalo and they'll tell you, you know, we can't keep up with the work. You know, people are just coming in like mad. So it's a high cost. And, you know, one of my governors that I follow, in addition to our hometown governor of Kathy Hochul, is the governor of Michigan, you know, Gretchen Whitmer. And she ran her whole first campaign on fixing Michigan roads. And she had exactly how much it cost every Michigander every year extra because the roads weren't fixed. And how it really impacted people who are living on fixed incomes, you know, both the working poor, you know, and the elderly. But that's just a basic responsibility, you know, that is owed. But we have so much quick growth to do in the city of Buffalo to tackle these issues. You know, you get your property tax bill every year, it opens up like an accordion. Like you gotta be a CPA to understand what the heck that bill really means, right? But it's bizarro looking. Same thing with the user fee. I mean, these are not easy to negotiate, but the city charges a real high interest rate on being late. So it doesn't seem like they have an incentive to actually have bills paid on time. They pay you a surcharge to pay your bill online. That's the exact opposite, I mean, of what's supposed to happen. You know, I pay my mortgage online and I get a discount from the bank because what they want is consistent payments. They don't look at paying your bill online as a little profit center.
Convenience fee.
Yeah, it's a convenience fee. So we just have a lot of things upside down.
Gretchen Whitmer is an interesting example. And she's been successful because, and this will lead into the next question then, you know, I listened to an interview with her and, you know, when she was early in her campaign, she went out and was just asking people, you know, what did they want? Yep. What did they want? And so the roads came up and they came up and they came up and they came up. So her actual campaign slogan and the sign said, fix the damn roads. Mm-hmm. But she's been successful because she fixed the damn roads. Right?
Well, you might have noticed one of my TV ads saying, I'm going to fix the damn potholes. Yeah. And that resonated. you know, just like it resonated with the people of Michigan. But now it's on me, right? So
absolutely. And that's,
I ran on the promise of fixing the basics, including the roads. Now we have to go fulfill the promises. And that's what I want to be judged by, right? That's my open dashboard. You know, I ran on the basics and taking on the tough issues. And I'm here to be judged. Like, my report card is going to be out there for everyone to see. Are the roads being fixed? Yes or no? Are the pools being open? I had a laugh this year that the acting mayor put a press release out saying, all the pools are open. But it was Orwellian, because it was all the pools are open that they said were going to, that they said they were opening this week. So it didn't mean the pools all over the city were open. It just meant all the pools on this list were open. So, you know, you go to MLK Park, you got a greenhouse that I just helped put $1.5 million in that is in really bad shape. You have a casino that's boarded up. You know, you have a splash pad that doesn't function terrifically. And then behind the casino is a pool. And it's a beautiful pool. And this will be its fourth or fifth summer not open. You know, it's inexcusable that this has become the norm in the city of Buffalo. You go to some community centers. Some are great and perfect. But that means somebody in the governing apparatus really put a lot of effort into making sure money kept going to that center. But there are other centers who didn't have those patrons, and they look like they're falling apart. I mean, go to the Esserisi Matters Community Center on the west side. Pool hasn't been open in years. The building itself is showing substantial signs of decay, and programming inside has absolutely, you know, fallen off. But we owe this to our kids. We owe it to our seniors. You know, this is what makes Buffalo a place you want to live in. You know, people leave Buffalo because they said they want to move to West Seneca to get services. I want to move to Amherst to get services. But nothing makes me more mad than that, because they have to move to get basic forms of governance, basic level of services, mind you, that they're paying for already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I drive down Grant Street every single day, and I can't remember the last time I saw that pool open.
Yep. And you can even say, let's talk about Grant Street for a minute. Three different kinds of streetlights. No uniformity. Sidewalks haven't been done on most of Grant Street in my lifetime. The street's been milled and overlaid so many times that there's barely any curbs. Empty tree pits. There's been no plan for Grant Street. You know, I had my assembly office over there. We're working like heck on trying to get the city to do a foundation-to-foundation redo of Grant Street. You know, it's a small commercial district. It's dense. It has everything that should make a commercial district work effectively. But the city just is letting it languish. And it's a real, real shame.
So just a couple more questions. I want to ask you about how you think a leader is informed. And the reason I ask that is because I think, again, to go to people's sort of pessimism about government, I think there's these feelings that, like, oh, they're just working for the rich guys. On, if you're of one mindset, and the other mindset is, oh, they're just working for the, you know, nonprofit think tanks or whatever. And so how do you actually feel that as a leader, or are you informed as a leader?
I read a lot, and I like to read about conceptual ideas, but then I like to read about things that are actually being applied on the ground, you know, in different cities. So I started becoming interested in public policy when I went to my first vacancy and abandonment conference in Pittsburgh. And it was all cities like Buffalo and Pittsburgh, you know, all suffering from deindustrialization, white flight, capital flight, you know, how you're fighting and how you're combating that. But there's so many laboratories just within a 4 or 5 hour drive of Buffalo, cities that have turned around, cities that have changed. Pittsburgh's got no evidence that there was steel town on the landscape anymore. You can't see it. It's all been gone. It's all been brownfield. It's been cleaned up. It's been commercialized. It's been made into parks. They figured it out. You know, you go to Montreal, we always say we can't do all these things in Buffalo because it's too cold. Well, Montreal makes us look like a bunch of winter wimps. Like, they are so cold up there. But boy, in the summertime, they put up temporary bike lanes that are just there for a season. Every sort of restaurant and shop owner expands out to their curb. It's easy to get a permit to put a second porch on your curb. There's a day you have to put it up, and there's a day you have to take it down. And, you know, they've done so many smart things to really embrace their summertime and to stretch their summer out. And ours is much longer, you know, than theirs. But, you know, we can look at just so many places, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Montreal, they're all around us of how they've used, you know, smart policies and made their cities a nicer place to live, more responsive to their citizens, more fun. You know, like the fun in Buffalo has sort of dissipated. You know, there's no Gus Macker basketball tournament. You know, there is, you know, used to have a citywide drill team competition, you know, and it's culminated in a big event at the Bill Stadium where all the kids competed. Kids kept busy all summer long practicing on that stuff. We got rid of that after either the red-green budget or the city control board period. So the only things we used to do, we used to fund the baseball leagues. Well, you know, Shoshone Baseball has more kids than ever playing baseball and softball there, but it's only because all the other leagues around the city have closed down. So if you want to have your kid play baseball or softball, you got to bring them over, you know, to this. So, you know, we've just been in this austerity mindset, you know, for so long. But it's really sapped a lot of our soul out of the city of Buffalo, and we have to turn it around.
Since you mentioned reading, the last question I'll ask you, because I've asked this of everyone, is are you familiar with Ezra Klein's book, Abundance?
I am. I'm more of a Matt Desmond guy than an Ezra Klein guy. You know, I find a lot of Ezra's policies are really reflective of the anomaly cities in North America, the San Franciscos, the Chicagos, the New York cities. And Matt Desmond's policies, and he studies housing and housing trends, are the Milwaukees, the Flints, the Albuquerques, the Buffaloes, you know, the Akron, Ohios. I think studying those cities are much more informative than, you know, trying to figure something out that they did, you know, in Brooklyn or something they did in an area of San Francisco, because those places often have an abundance of wealth to help fund a lot of these things. I listened to a great podcast once where Matt Desmond was on like WNYC. He was being interviewed, and he talked about a housing policy he was promoting, and the host said, well, won't that just promote gentrification? And Matt Desmond said, let me ask you a question. I'm guessing you're from Chicago, San Francisco, or New York. And the host said, yeah, I am. I did my grad work at University of Chicago. Now I lived in Brooklyn. He said, exactly. Because what you're talking about, they exist in those cities, but they don't exist in most of the other cities, you know, in America. And the places with the highest eviction rates are not the places of those cities of great abundance. You know, Albuquerque, New Mexico had the highest eviction rates for years. The formerly redlined cities have the highest eviction rates, and they also have the lowest rent differential between poor neighborhoods and not poor neighborhoods. Because, you know, the one of the many sins of the red lines are people are captive behind the red line, and they don't think they can rent in another part of the city because they'd be discriminated against. So in that part of the city, for substandard housing, the rent's often more than on Ashland or Norwood Avenue.
Well, I would agree with you. But his latest book, and why I find it is an interesting conversation point, is about some of the things that you're talking about, which is making government actually work and getting things done. And that his argument is that for a long time, we've created so much kind of, it's not just regulation, but it's just systems that prevent things from actually happening.
I get it. Like CECRA laws, environmental laws. I just think he takes it, you know, too far. Like the his acolytes are always saying, oh, Buffalo needs to allow ADUs and change its zoning laws. I'm like, we have ADUs all over Buffalo. We've always had things, but he likes to take these specific ideas that he's encountered and generalize them far and wide.
I would agree. They can't be generalized. Yeah. And one of the things
is not holding up housing being built in the city of Buffalo. But a lot of his main arguments is, oh, zoning causes the housing crisis. Once again, maybe in Chicago or Houston, but you know, no one's not building a house at a vacant lot on the west side because of zoning prohibitions.
Well, I think that is that's a recent change, though, because I will say in selling vacant lots as in real estate for a long time, they were impossible to sell because every attorney would tell their client if they wanted, like people have wanted to build houses in Buffalo for a long time, and they would tell
their client. Well, let's just be clear. Where do they want to build houses in Buffalo, Jam?
Well, this would be even on the west side 10 or 15 years ago. Because right. People were thinking, look, I can buy a lot for $500. I could build a house. And their attorney would say, go to City Hall first and ask them if you're allowed to build there.
Yeah.
And the answer every single time was no.
Yeah. But when did we remedy that?
And so that has changed absolutely with the green code.
Yeah.
But what my point is that I think that there's these
other cities, they put so many intentionally restrictive things in. And that we don't have those.
We don't. And but I think that one of the things, and then we'll wrap up, is that you have brought up about Buffalo and having strategic plans for all of these areas. One of the interesting things about this city is that there is all of this space. So it can also involve a total rethinking of what, let's say, two square blocks of vacant property is maybe we don't need to fill that with houses. Maybe that becomes a park or something like. So I think that that's what's interesting about Buffalo, you know, as long as I've lived here, actually, is that there's all these opportunities to think really outside the box.
Yep. And that thinking sometimes evolves. And that's why it's important in the near term to invest our housing resources into completing neighborhoods that have gaps. And the large swaths of green space, we can figure out what to do with them, you know, down the road. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, what we don't want to ever have is people buying five lots and putting a house up on them. You know, we don't want to create Clarence in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And so we got to be careful, you know, with how we distribute lots. But going back to Michigan Avenue, like today is a great example, like between, you know, the Michigan Avenue Baptist Church, the Nash House, is a triangle of how of activities, but there's about 14 vacant lots in the middle of it. Now, I'm a big supporter of saying that those 14 lots, you know, should be landscaped so you can be able to go between these three historic sites, you know, without having to get back in your car. You know, make it appealing, make it beautiful, make it a cooling place for a day like today, you know, rather than trying to, you know, put some infill in there. But there's a lot to do. And the last thing we need to talk about is that, you know, we need to really have the Office of New Americans in City Hall be a functioning office. You know, be an office that makes sure that language access is granted and that we have all the information up on our city website and all the different languages, and to make sure that nobody is denied opportunity in the city of Buffalo because their English language skills, you know, aren't proficient. And we don't ever want to be in a situation where, you know, pre-adolescent kids are coming to City Hall with their parents to translate for them. So we don't want that to happen. And as the Trump administration has really cracked down on, you know, refugees coming in, which really led to our population growth, you know, we need to be out there and be active in marketing Buffalo as a place that is friendly to new Americans, and that, you know, our Burmese population and our Northern African populations, you know, talk to your friends living in other parts of the country, say to move to Buffalo, say why you should move to Buffalo, what a great welcoming city it is, because we're only getting our population growth. And you know how we do it in America. You're not really growing your economy unless you have population growth. We're not going to have population growth unless we get more new Americans to move to Buffalo. But then we also have to have hundreds of new homes online to give people a place to live. Because all the houses that were used to be out there and abandoned that you could pick up, they're mostly gone now. So we're not going to have an expanded population unless we have more units around the city.
I would agree with that. And I would say, as one final sort of boots on the ground kind of insight into that is, I think that is something that doesn't get talked about in terms of how the West Side kind of rejuvenated was, as far as I see it, just being on the street, working in real estate and having rentals, that the immigrants moving into the West Side were a tremendous impact. It's not just the Five Points and the things that we see.
So. No, it's when, our plan with PUSH was going to take us decades to refill a small area of the West Side, and then Burmese people started moving in.
Yep, it's...
And houses that nobody wanted, suddenly people wanted to live in, and it's changed it like that. Yeah. But you know what the glory of the West Side is? With all these changes, the poverty rate change from like 2010 to 2020 has been minuscule. Because most of the people, a lot of people living in the West Side, regardless of the wealth, were homeowners already. So we didn't have a big displacement going on. And people who were moving into vacant houses didn't displace people either. So Matt Desmond or Ezra Klein should come to Buffalo and see how we've repopulated our neighborhoods without doing massive displacement.
That would be a good conversation.
Yeah.
So, Sean, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
I look forward to continuing the conversations.